Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 627 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Superman Sunday episode, and today I'm going to be continuing the post-crisis chronology of Superman by looking at The World of Krypton issue number 3. This is written by John Byrne. We have breakdowns by Mike Mignola, finishes by Rick Bryant, colors are by Petra Scotese, letters are by John Workman. Mike Carlin is the editor. And the cover is by a couple of legends. We've got John Byrne and Walter Simonson on the cover. So let me dive right into the story. It starts as the previous two issues both have, talking about the Hantha blossoms. And it is the same view of that Kryptonian tower that was shining in issue 1. Was quite wrecked and somewhat destroyed in issue 2, and now it looks like has been returned to glory. So a big splash page of a giant Kryptonian structure that really, in a way, shows us where Krypton is as a society. You know, the first image we saw in that first issue, very bright, very sleek, flyers and vehicles and such flying around, the sun shining, very much an idyllic image, so to speak. Whereas the same image of the same structure in issue 2, there were chunks taken out of it, somewhat destroyed, the sky was gray, a world at war, everything was desolate and dystopian. And now in this issue, the structure has been rebuilt and it looks advanced. It looks sturdy, but the sky is not quite so bright. It's not a bright blue sky with a shining sun. The sky's got more of a greenish hue. The sun is somewhat muted. The landscape around isn't green and verdant as we saw in that first issue. Everything is just much more stark. So you get the impression that while this is a society that is not at war and is somewhat stable, they're not thriving in the way that initial society was, that those beings that loved life and had just wonderful interpersonal relationships and such. So in this image, we see that there is a flyer heading toward the tower, and within the tower itself, we find that it is the tower of the family of El, and Jor-El, first son of the family, is looking back over the history, the bloody carnage in holographic images of that war, of that clone war, the war of clone rights. So as he is viewing that, we see some robots in the background that are discussing amongst themselves how concerned they are. The young master just spends ever greater amounts of time studying the history imagers, and maybe it's not healthy to have such a preoccupation with the long dead past. And Kellex, who is a name that longtime Superman fans will know as kind of the major domo of the Fortress of Solitude, says, "Yes, the young master is unlike other Kryptonians. His heart is great, and he feels the suffering of those ancient masters as surely as if it were his own." And they wonder again about the unusualness of it, especially to be so engrossed on this of all days as sort of a foreboding of or a premonition of what's to come. So we get a little bit of look into what exactly is being shown on the holo screens there, the holographic images. And these are all things that we knew or we learned in the first couple issues about how there was a clone for three different stages of every Kryptonian's life. So every Kryptonian at birth had three cells taken from their body. Three clones were grown, a young version, sort of a middle-aged version, and an older version. And what these clones were used for, they were basically living organic organ donors. And there were those among the Kryptonians who believed that this was an abomination. And they believed that these clones should be freed and allowed to live their own lives. And it talks about the scandal that we saw in the first issue where Neera had freed one of her clones and allowed her to develop her own personality, as she felt there was no one else on Krypton, no other female who was a worthy consort for her son. And her son, finding this to be an abomination, killed the clone of her mother, killed his mother, and tried to kill himself, but was prevented from doing that by being captured. But Neera's crime spread, or the word of Neera's crime spread, and it caused an uprising. There was a nuclear device that was detonated in the capital city of Kandor that destroyed it. It brought rise to a faction known as Black Zero, which was sort of a radicalized arm of this anti-clone movement, one that was willing to take drastic means, any means necessary to stop cloning and the use of clones to prolong Kryptonian life, and the war for clone rights that thus followed. So we see, as through Jor-El's eyes, what happened after the end of issue two. Issue two, Van-El went and met with Black Zero, went and met with some of the clone underground, so to speak, those that were opposed to it, and was looking for a way to end the war, to finally confront Black Zero, that radicalized arm, and try to bring all three factions, both the more moderate group of anti-clone followers, the Kryptonian government, what remains of it, and Black Zero itself. So even though it's a flashback, it's basically just a continuation of what we saw last issue, or at the end of last issue. So Van-El and the doctor that he met there, of the moderate faction of the anti-clone group, they head to the citadel of Black Zero, and we get an interlude here, or perhaps back to the perhaps that's the interlude, because it's the flashback, the what Jor-El's seen on the holographic images, and we find out what exactly is going on in the citadel, or the fortress of the House of El, that the robots are talking about. This, of all days, he's engrossed in the histories, and what we find is that Jor-El's father, Segel, is there with the mother of Jor-El's betrothed. So it appears that in this time in Kryptonian history, that marriages are arranged. So as these three Kryptonians arrive, Jor-El asks after his son. Why does he not greet us himself? And Kellex responds, I apologize for the master. He promised that he'll join us as soon as he's done there. He's detained in the library. And Jor-El is forced to apologize for his son. And Nara, whose granddaughter is the betrothed of Jor-El, says, there's no need. My granddaughter also is very interested in history. Perhaps their joining will produce a great historian. And we see that the third Kryptonian that's there is the master of the gestation chambers. And because Jor-El and Laura have been selected, they are a near-perfect genetic match. And we also see that the third Kryptonian there with Segem and Nara is the master of the gestation chambers, because there's not ever actually any contact between these betrothed. They don't really marry, so to speak, but rather their genetic material is taken and used to produce a new Kryptonian that will help to propagate the species and allow evolution and the best traits of the Kryptonians to survive. And he mentions that Jor-El and Laura have been selected because of their near-perfect genetic matrix, not because of any developed traits. So he has his doubts on whether or not this match will produce a great historian, as Nara mentioned. So Segem, rather, is ready for his son to appear. He's not going to tolerate this tardiness, and he tells Kellex to go and bring the young son to the reception level at once. So Kellex heads off, wondering all the while how he's going to pry the young master away and get him to honor a promise that he never truly made, which I find to be interesting. So it's a robot, it's artificial intelligence, and yet it lied to kind of cover for for Jor-El. So obviously, I mean, it's not really capable of emotion, right? I mean, it's a robot, but still there's something there in the artificial intelligence that some desire on Kellex's part to protect Jor-El from his father's wrath, so to speak. And for Jor-El's part, he's just absolutely enthralled by this this war of clone rights and this devastation and destruction and violence. You know, it's been thousands and thousands of years, and I think that enough time has gone by that and the way the Kryptonians have their society now, they're so cut off from their emotion and from each other. They don't really have interpersonal relationships much. They've forgotten the horror of it because, you know, 15-year-old Jor-El here is looking at these holographic images and saying, wow, magnificent, such fury, such ferociousness, such valor on both sides. There's admiration there, which in my mind, there should never be admiration for war. And it's almost like he's nostalgic for that time as he goes on to think, what an age, what a time that was. So meanwhile, as the two Kryptonian battle armors, one containing Van-El and the other containing the Doctor, get to their destination, they have arrived at the headquarters of Black Zero, and they exit their armors, but their armors are trained to follow them or set to automatically follow them. And they notice that most of the Black Zero followers here are unarmed. So they ask to be taken to the leader of the Black Zero movement. And as they are walking along, Van-El and this Doctor are conversing, and Van-El hears the Doctor talk about him in a very familiar way, as she says, once you were so much more trusting, were you not? So much more naive. It saddens me to think how much you've changed. And Van-El's thinking, she speaks as if from firsthand knowledge. Do I know this woman? Like, who is she? He's like, it's so hard to tell. You know, it's been 1,000 years of war, and so much can change. And she's changed more than most because of the harsh conditions she's lived under. And Van-El ends up thinking, well, maybe she's just guessing as much as anyone ever has. But any further thought is cut off as they arrive at the central chamber of the Black Zero headquarters. And they wonder at this egg-like shape that is floating there in the room. Van-El saying he's never seen anything so perfect, such exquisite engineering. He thought the skills had long since been lost. And it hovers over a shaft that goes down further than any of their suit scanners can reach. And the walls are arrow straight, smooth as glass. Like, what is this place? And they can't even guess. But Van-El says, whoever built it, though, was an engineering genius. And a voice off panel says, many thanks, Van-El. And before we can see what happens next, Jor-El's viewing is interrupted by Segem calling him. And Jor-El is very surprised to see him, saying, I did not expect you so soon. If you'll excuse me for a few more minutes, the tape is nearly done. And Segem says, no, there will be no more minutes. You've embarrassed me before two of the highest of Krypton. I shall brook no more delays. Come with me now. So Jor-El follows his father out of the room as the tapes continue to play. And we see that Van-El and this Doctor realize that the head of Black Zero, the man who's been leading this radical faction all along, is none other than Kanzi himself, who was once betrothed to his mother's clone. They thought him long dead, if not executed, then by his own hand. And his response is, well, I tried that, as you may well remember, but it was you, yourself, Van-El, who stayed my hand, and therefore you who set me firmly on the path I must now follow to its end. But you, my lady, I don't know your face, but you know mine, and it's a pity that now there's no time to rectify this matter. And Van-El's like, what are you talking about? Your forces are routed, you're defeated, you're our prisoner. There's a time for everything now. And Van-El says, well, so say you, Van-El, but you know nothing of time. Ages have marched. I've born, I've withered, I'm dying, and little by little with each passing day, I've been waiting for the moment the Silver Egg would hatch and pour out its nuclear yolk into the heart of our world and end time itself. So that's why the shaft is so deep. It literally goes to the heart of Krypton. And when the nuclear device in this silver spherical egg hatches and drops, it will destroy the world. And so the doctor says, you're insane. Even in the midst of defeat, you prattle on. You cling to the old madness. Your time has ended, Kanzi. The time has come at last for life. It's time to move past this war. And Kanzi's argument to that is, well, tell that to the millions that have died already. The mindless clones who gave pieces of themselves so a miserable race of cannibals could live. We don't deserve to live, right? Their souls call out for peace and justice. And in order for that to happen, this world must die. And Van El's response is, great Rao, how much longer do we hear the same old song? The ones you seek to punish are gone. The clone bakes have been abandoned. There are new ways to stretch a human life. Perhaps less efficient, but more acceptable, more humane. And the doctor says, Kanzi, look, Van El speaks the truth, and she shows a cybernetic arm. And Kanzi says, that's your solution? We're going to be turned into a race of cyborgs? And the doctor says, well, maybe it's not as aesthetically pleasing as a clone graft, but it's better than murdering the mindless. So yes, Kanzi, I agree with you. Once I even belong to your Black Zero. And that surprises Van El. He says, she once belonged to Black Zero. What? Something about her. For a moment, I thought I'd recognize her. Meanwhile, the doctor's asking Kanzi, is he ready to end the madness forever? And Kanzi says, well, you ask much, lady. And Van El says, you know, we were never friends, but in 1,000 years, I would hope that we've both learned some reason. And Kanzi walks over to the railing next to the shaft and says, reason, yes, perhaps you're right, young Van El, but if you are, then have I not wasted all these years? Wasted them? Not if I do this. And it turns out the railing is actually the trigger. As he turns it, the egg hatches. And everyone in the room is thrown back, but Kanzi manages to get to his battle armor, climb inside, and fire upon the egg and destroy it, keep it from falling down into the shaft. But the ensuing nuclear explosion pretty much vaporizes just about everybody who is in the room. Meanwhile, we see that Kanzi's children, Janelle, along with some others, have come to find the wreckage. They find their father's battle armor. They're able to dig him out, and he seems to have survived, although he's dangerously weak. But some of the others weren't so lucky, and Van El asks his son Xanar to put him down, let him walk, and they find the doctor who is on her last legs, basically, but it pleases her to see that Van El has survived. And he tells her, don't waste your energy on talk. We'll get you to the hospital station. She says, no, it's too late for that. No putting me back together this time, Van. And she expires before she finishes. And that's when Van El finally realizes it was Vara all along, his betrothed, his beloved, his friend. They had philosophical differences when the Clone Wars broke out. Their marriage was never to be. And through the harshness of the battles that she fought when she was part of Black Zero, before she came to lead the more moderate faction of the anti-clone movement, those battles had left her scarred and looking much different than Van El had remembered. So as Van El cradles her body, his children looking on, they say, Father, this woman was known to you? And Van El's response is, after a fashion, my son, in a different reality, she might have been your mother. And so that is how the Clone Wars came to an end. But Jor-El obviously didn't see that, as he has been escorted by his father to meet Nara and the master of the gestation chambers. And as he walks into the receiving chamber, he thanks his elders for their patience and begs forgiveness that he let his own interests keep them from the meeting. And Nara accepts his apology and says he is forgiven. And now to the matter at the center of this gathering, apparently there's been the untimely death of a Kryptonian. Zon-Im has expired. And Jor-El says, yes, I was troubled by that news. Death is so rare in this society. And the master of the gestation chamber says, yes, that's quite so. But what you may not have realized is this creates an opening in the register of citizens. So apparently this version of Krypton at this time, everything is so regulated that they control the amount of Kryptonians that are actually alive. And so the master tells Jor-El that he has been chosen to father the new Kryptonian that will fill the opening. And Jor-El is very shocked. He says, I haven't even taken the rites of passage by Kryptonian law. I'm still a child myself. And the master responds, true enough. And the matter is not to be set upon here now. However, as you yourself have pointed out, the necessity of such things is so rare that I decided that you would need the time to prepare yourself emotionally for the honor. So there's time for you to think on it, to reflect on it, and to take your rites of passage before this event is going to occur. So Jor-El is very taken aback. He says he doesn't have the words to properly express his gratitude, and Jor-El says none are needed. You need only give the address of respect to Nara, who's grandmother of the female child chosen as your mate. So Jor-El says with great pleasure, and he speaks to the grandmother saying, hail Nara, daughter of Krypton, may the mingling of our families bring forth only wisdom and tranquility. So again, Nara says, well said, I'm pleased by this union, but Jor-El's not quite finished. To the utter embarrassment of his father once again, he says, I have but one request, Lady Nara, were it possible to see your granddaughter. And Zeg-Im says, what? Are you determined to offend this gathering, Jor-El? But Nara says, be at peace, Sigel. The request is quite unorthodox, but I see no reason it shouldn't be granted. And she then shows Jor-El an image of her granddaughter, Lara, and Jor-El is taken aback by her beauty. So again, these two, Lara and Jor-El, were to, you know, mix their genetic material and sire a new Kryptonian to fill the space in the registry of citizens for Krypton, get back up to that, you know, ceiling that they like to stay at. And yet the two were never meant to meet or see each other. So again, as reflected on that first page, like I talked about when the issue started, about how that first scene we saw of that Kryptonian tower and the blue skies and the verdant landscape and the joy of life the Kryptonians seemed to have, to the point where they wanted those lives to last a very long time, indefinitely. And thus the advent of using clones to replace organs that failed or any parts of the body that were damaged in accidents or due to disease or sickness, and without possibly thinking about the consequences of that. But again, I feel like it was done out of a couple of things, you know, a joy of life, a desire for it to last as long as possible. Also the advancement of science, the fact they were able to do that, the desire to live longer, to learn more, to accumulate more knowledge. And then it all leading to the downfall of the society. And so when society was rebuilt where we are here and now, it seems like they try to suppress emotion. They try to limit relationships, all those things that can lead to conflict, right? Disagreements of, you know, philosophical disagreements on how to prolong life. Let's go completely analytical. Let's go live in a completely antiseptic society where the aesthetics of things and ritual and protocols and such are, you know, everything is so rigid and controlled. There's a much less chance of any kind of conflict, whether that be interpersonal conflict, whether that be differences in philosophy that eventually lead to war and destruction. So you can kind of understand how an advanced society would get to the state that they're at here, but you also have to wonder about everything that they've given up. Like, what's the point of living other than to accumulate knowledge if you can have no joy, you can have no happiness? You don't even enjoy beauty and things like that, because like the joys of parenthood, the beauty of your mate falling in love with somebody, like all that stuff, it's all like thrown out the window. You know, it's a very restrictive, you could almost say a fascist society where everything is so controlled. And again, I understand why they did it based on the War of Clone Rights and how it almost destroyed Krypton, like literally almost destroyed the whole planet. If Kanzi had had his way, they came, within an eyelash of that happening. And so now it's almost like the pendulum has swung back too far the other way. So one issue to go of this limited series. I really do like the way this version of Krypton and Byrne's ideas of society. Obviously, it has changed over time, but I think a lot of this from the series, and I've talked about it before, is a lot of the inspiration for the Krypton television series that's currently on. So I should be covering the last issue in just a couple of weeks. I think next week on Superman Sunday, we're going to be talking about Supergirl 25. And then the week after that, I think will probably be Superman 5. And then the last week, last Sunday of December, I should be covering the last issue of World of Krypton. So look for that. And then we'll move on to the World of Metropolis. It's a 4-issue, also written by John Byrne. And then after that will be the World of Smallville. And again, these are all just set up to kind of set the status quo of where Superman was when he debuted in John Byrne's Superman, his Action Comics, and Adventures of Superman. Because you have to remember, after the Man of Steel miniseries, where Byrne kind of rebooted the origin of Superman, or not rebooted, but kind of updated, modernized him after this Crisis on Infinite Earth. In those first issues, it wasn't like, okay, here's Superman appearing for the first time. No, he had been around for years and everybody kind of knew him and this was the status quo. And so these World of series were a way to fill in some of the backstory of where Superman was. So once again, I want to thank everybody for joining. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.